and with Krishna, I want you to hear, or we will read together, the next quote. In your series, there's one called Krishna Nam, Dham, and Kam. If you can find that one, why not put that one next into your book? Hoping that there's sufficient tape on the back to hold it, at least until you can use some other sticking. Yeah, there are two sheets. There are two sheets. You can pop them both in next to each other. Does everyone have everything? Yeah? All the sheets? You have all the sheets? Yeah. Now this is an attempted, I wouldn't say summary, but a presentation from the book of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's writings, wherein sometimes the editing of his words is not done so well, and the sentences run on. Sometimes one sentence begins and ends after a paragraph about this long, so it's a little bit. It takes a lot of concentration to read his words in their unedited form. So this is a little editing that's taking place here to try to get these concepts into a form where we can read them and look at them. So this is three things: Krishna Nam, Krishna Dham, and Krishna Kam. This is what the subject matter is about. So I'm going to start reading, and then I will let other people read a little bit also. The service of the holy name, the holy Dham, and the supreme desire of Godhead is available to all of us. No one can extricate themselves from the wrong understandings and the clutches of worldly inclinations without Sri Nam, or the divine holy name. So what is it that one can extricate oneself from? By the holy name? Clutches of worldly inclination, what does that mean? Material desires, what else? The mind, yes. I and mine, the concept of I and mine. The mind, the material world itself. Lording propensity, yes, all of these. Mm. And the other one was wrong understandings. I'm the body.
I'm God.
That's a good one. Oh, sorry. I thought I was meeting a celebrity. Any more that we can think of are wrong understandings? Yeah, that I will live forever. How about I can be happy here? Any more? I am the body. I am God. I will live forever, and I will be happy here. I have absolute knowledge. So in this sense, absolute knowledge, I know everything. Supreme Lord is impersonal, a very important one that's going to come up here. Very good. Supreme Lord is impersonal. When you read very, very much, and as I said, I've had the good fortune to do that, to prepare this for you, more than I would normally read, you come across in many, many cases, in many, many ways, how this impersonalism is so inherent in the living entity's heart. I was reading this afternoon even how Srila Prabhupada was explaining that, actually Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, how the living entity has to get rid of the idea of a personal God if he wants to enjoy here without any sense of guilt and shame. He has to say there is nobody in control, because as soon as he says someone in control, as soon as there is some kind of a structure there, he might get into trouble for something that he's doing. So to avoid any kind of feeling of discomfort, he has to come to this position of impersonalism. Yes. Yes, and then there's no God.
Atheism.
Yeah, atheism. Yeah, they're very similar in a sense. Impersonalism gives you the comfort that there is a God, but he's not a God. He's not a anyone. He's just this. He's love. God is love. God is everything. God is the supreme something in the universe. He's something very vague. And the other thing Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains why impersonalism is so valued in Kali Yuga is because it's like it's a neutral concept that you can add anything to. So if I want to worship animals, I can do that. If I want to worship this, if I want to worship the universe, anything, I can attach it to impersonalism. Because if there's no personal, that means there's no controller. Prabhupada, when he was saying in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, that the idea of God is different than the idea of the summum bonum, or the absolute truth, he goes on to say that one thing that we hold in common with a person who is somebody trying to understand God is that, of course, they say God is the controller, so everyone knows that a controller has to be a person. So we acknowledge that when they say God is the controller, they're acknowledging personal, he has to be personal. So we see that all our line, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, even more and Srila Prabhupada, if at all possible to say that, is so much against impersonalism. He would call it, Prabhupada called it, the impersonal calamity when he was glorifying Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And I find for myself, when I think, how does this affect me? It affects me in the idea that I don't have a clear enough conception of God as a person to love him, or to think that he would love me, or to think that I could have a fruitful relationship with him. And because he's so vague, and he's not very attractive, and people are enormously attractive, my family or my friends or so on and so forth, I'm completely given to the personal relating with them, but I don't carry that same personalism in my relationship with God, with Krishna. I don't have that. So I personally can see how much one becomes crippled. It's not that one doesn't believe in God, one doesn't necessarily want to say, I go that far. I believe he's there, I believe in Krishna, I believe, but it's not substantial enough, it's not vivid enough to actually allow us to fall in love with him. That would sound silly. And when you read the Chaitanya Bhagavat about the associates of Lord Chaitanya, and they're crying all the time. Anyone who's read Chaitanya Bhagavat knows they just cry all the time. They meet each other and cry. They roll on the ground. They leave each other. They cry. They just keep crying. And after a while, I notice sometimes when I'm listening, I'm just letting it go in. But every now and again, I think, why are they crying so much? What's wrong with them? You know, there's no feeling there. What could they be feeling to be crying so much? And so when one is described, when somebody very elevated describes an elevated state of love of Krishna, I'm just left with a kind of an empty feeling of kind of, can't relate to that. So this is due to this impersonalism and atheism. And atheism is always married to materialism. Materialism has to have atheism. They have to go together. You can't have one without the other. You can't be a materialist and be a real theist. You can't be, because everything material, a real theist knows it belongs to God. So how can you rampantly just enjoy it as your own whim? So these two things are always, you see them together, materialism and atheism. And Srila Prabhupada said, impersonalism has led to rampant materialism in the world because nobody can be satisfied with an impersonal God. This is not a satisfying experience. You can say you're satisfied with it because it allows you so much scope and freedom for whatever you want to do, but it doesn't satisfy the heart. We're all looking for personal persons. But as Kali Yuga goes on, even that, even with people, personalism will become less and less and less and less. And people become, as Prabhupada used, a polished royal edition of the animals. Where all they think about is the royal me. I'm the only one that's important. And this, you can see this happening already. Okay, back to this. So we've got some wrong understanding and some worldly inclinations in place. And it is said that no one can extricate oneself from these without the divine holy name. Alright. Sri Nam, the holy name. As a result of serving Krishna's holy name, one can free oneself from the hold of prejudices and superstitions and become settled in the service of the desire of Krishna, Krishna Kam Seva. From prejudices and superstitions. And so Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur would call so many things that people just take for granted, superstitions, different ways that people respond or they equate their understanding of reality. He said that's a superstition. Superstition meaning that it's not actually true, but one believes this. And because one believes it, one feels that if I go against this, this will be a very bad thing. I must keep this here and that there. But they have a superstition, not a truth that they're actually upholding and protecting. So this can be avoided, or it can be corrected, or it can, the result is that it will be removed. These prejudices, superstitions, wrong understandings and worldly inclinations by the mercy of the holy name. And then, this is an interesting point, because we're asked, as we learn how to surrender to Krishna, to consider that Krishna is our maintainer and our protector. These are two elements of bhakti, surrender. But we see here that the Christians, in their general mood, they also accept that God should protect me, and they say, the Lord is my Father, our Father which art in heaven, give us this day our daily bread. And Srila Prabhupada would criticize and say, look at this attitude. They're asking God, give me, give me, give me, as if he's their order supplier. So then I find this is interesting. You're saying that he is our maintainer protector. Does that mean he's our maintainer protector, but we're not allowed to ask him for anything? What is the difference between this mentality that is considered God is my supplier, give me this, give me this, give me this, and the one that is actually a mood of surrender? So this shift from one as an order supplier to one as a mood of surrender, it comes about by the process of chanting, and as we gradually gain sufficient faith in Krishna to accept him and his desire in the foreground and not our own. In the beginning, we pray to him, please give me this, please give me this. I work out what I need. Now you please give it to me. And he is giving. This one is inferior to when we say, what do you want? I want to do what you want. I'm ready now. I'm mature enough now in my experience of reciprocation with you. I'm mature enough to be able to say, what do you want? And if I'm not, then I should continue with my chanting of the holy name. And it will come if I chant in sincerely trying not to be offensive in my chanting. It will come. That level of faith will arrive. Now, further, the next paragraph. Please underline anything that strikes you as we're going along. The only spiritual entity or reality who has mercifully descended to this world is the name of Krishna, who dwells in his transcendental abode. Now this, does that strike anyone? How lucky we are. And also, what struck me was how many times I don't think of the name of Krishna as a person. I just don't. And these this is one of the offences to consider Krishna's name to be not to be different. But I don't have, because nothing here that I know, a pen, I put the pen there, I say pen, the pen is there and the word is here. So I don't have this experience in my life of things that are the same as their name. If I go into the other room and I call all of you, you're here, you have to make an effort to come there. You and your name are different, but Krishna and his name are the same. So here, he's the only living, he's the only spiritual entity who descends to where we are. The transcendental locality where he manifests himself and displays his activities is Sri Dham. So now he's relating the Dham to the name of Krishna, who he is saying is no different than Krishna himself. By the service of Sri Dham, the service of the holy name, and the all-holy desire of Krishna is attained. So now I'm going to underline that. The service of Sri Dham. I'm going to ask you, what does that mean? Can anyone unlock some of the mystery of this? What does it mean, the service of Sri Dham? By the service of Sri Dham, the service of the holy name, and the all-holy desire of Krishna is attained. How do we serve the Dham? We could serve the Dham by chanting the name. Yes. Taking the dust. Following instructions of Guru.
Serving the residents of the Dham.
Cleaning the Dham, yeah, doing menial service in the Dham. One time Deva Shakti Mataji asked all the devotees who were staying in Krishna Balaram Mandir if they would like to come out in a group and take all the plastic bags and all the garbage that was on the sides of the hills of Varshana. And they brought out big Hessian bags and took bags and bags and bags and bags away. And one of the parts of our, it was either the last retreat or the one before at Govardhan, we did something similar. The last one, we had 20 minutes, everybody should serve by cleaning, because it's so menial. And it's so joy-filled, it's such a funny thing. You start seeing, oh, there's a cigarette butt, there's a this, there's a that. Pick it up, make a pile, throw it somewhere. And it was very funny, it was only for 20 minutes, but it just lifts your spirits. So we have to ask, why does it lift my spirits? And we might think it's just because good exercise, we like to be clean, those things are good for one. No, it's because you're serving the Dham. You're doing those things that are all good, but you're doing them in service of the Dham.
So if
we're
not
cleaning
the Dham,
yes. The answer would have to be a yes and no. We'd have to be a yes and no. That's as far as I can enter into the subject. Mm-hmm. Yes and no. One thing that is a very essential service of the Dham that that you will all think of immediately is parikram. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Parikram, because in parikram you'll see all the angas of bhakti are there. There's devotees, there's hearing about the Dham, there's the kirtan, there's everything is there within parikram. So hearing, chanting, yes? Serving the deity, yes, in the Dham. Yes. Now again, all these things that we've mentioned here pretty much, they all also apply to another Dham, to a simple Dham like a temple, or even to, you can do all of these things in your own home and you'll bring auspiciousness. I think the difference would be said that where the deity is installed, if you pick up the deity and take the deity away, then that place, it remains invisibly sacred, but it can appear to diminish its sacred quality. whereas Srivrindavan Dham, Mayapur Dham, these great transcendental places, they're so deep and so transcendental because they're actually facsimiles of the places within the spiritual world. They're actually eternal residences of the Lord. They exist eternally within the material world, like an embassy. And so no matter how many people come there with so much nonsense, they can dump everything there. And the Dham may be in one sense covered, but it's never touched because it's not of this world. So this is, we can strive to bring that same atmosphere, that Dham-like atmosphere, in our house, in our heart, in our temple. But there it radiates as if like a spring. It comes like an eternal spring up. So by service there, we can get very deep samskaras that we can bring here. And we can use them here. If no one has seen there, it will be, this comes up, actually, that the Dham is very essential as a part, as an under of bhakti. Let's continue. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has made his advent in that Dham. In this section, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is talking about Mayapur. But the same things apply to both. Has made his advent in that Dham and has made the world conscious of the spirituality of a holy place. Now, this is a section that... Now, I put these Nam Dham sections in here to make it a little easier so they overlap. But this is more about the Dham. The Sanskrit word Dham has different lexiconical meanings. That means if you look it up in the dictionary, you will find these words. A Dham means the rays, prowess, influence, home, place, the body, birth, etc. But in the sense in which it is understood by wise seers of the truth, it means that regional place where there is no scope of any desire of malice, for malice, injury, envy, or mortality, and which is ever self-effulgent, spiritual, and blissful. So there is a very powerful definition of the Dham. A place where there is no scope of any desire for malice, injury, envy, mortality, self-effulgent, spiritual, and blissful. So I think we may not have come up with those exact words, but we came very close with our definitions. So someone may, at this point, they may think, wow, when I've been to Vrindavan Dham, I've been to Mayapur, it doesn't seem exactly like that. People are a little harsh. You know, it's not that, they're not envious, and you know they can, and people die there too. It says here that there's no mortality. And malice, you know, people fight. I've seen the devotees even fighting there. So what does this relate to? And here, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur can help us to understand. He explains that there's a very, very thin covering over the holy Dham of the modes of nature. The modes of nature here, all over the world, within the material world, they're predominant. And if you try to dive into the modes of nature in Australia, New Zealand, or anywhere else, you go deep, 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 and down like an ocean, and you won't come to the end of them. But the holy Dham is just covered like a gift wrap of these modes of nature, and just under the surface are these transcendental aspects. So when one goes there, if one has no interest in the spiritual nature of the Dham, they will rest on the top and they will sport and play with the modes of nature. They will still attain some benefit, but it won't be spiritual benefit. Meaning, they won't necessarily come from that place with any spiritual realization whatsoever. They may say, that was really nice, I felt really peaceful there, I felt so many things, but they won't get the spiritual benefit if they, Prabhupada mentions this in another verse, if they go there for sightseeing. So we should note that. You will stay on that very, very thin, like ice, over the river. If you want to go in, you have to go with a heart that is eager to actually experience what is a Dham, what is the holy nature of the Dham. Now, Surya, can you read the next two sections there? The service here.
Yeah.
Now, let me stop there for a second. This is what struck me when I first read this. It's the most... read it and went right over the top. And I had to go back. And this really struck me, that this is actually what the Dharma offers. This is the statement of the Dharma. If you go to Govardhan, if you go to Radhakund, if you go to anywhere in Navadvip, they are all places of activities of the Supreme Lord in his different forms. When he came here, he did this, he did that. So it's actually impossible, if you're sincere, to go away from the Dharma thinking that, oh, I don't know about Krishna consciousness, I don't know about Krishna. What happens is it impregnates in your mind that Krishna is real and that his activities are real. What's there before you go to the Dharma and what's difficult to erase is this idea that I'm the Lord and my activities are real. Whatever I do, that's reality. And there's no existence except in the human imagination of the name, form, attributes and pastimes of God. Is there just something that we... Not mythology, I wouldn't go so far as to say that, but they don't seem quite real. But when you go to the Dharma, they become real. Because the places are there. And if you go and visit those places and touch those places, and if you associate with those places, you come away and something has changed. I remember, Jamanachari, you were talking about your first visit to the Dharma and how difficult it was going for the first time. But something changed. Right? You were making that comment. It's like that. It's very confronting sometimes on one's first visit. Sometimes it's very blissful and one feels just very elated. But sometimes it's extremely confronting because you think, why is it so confronting? What's the problem? Because you're forced to accept that Krishna, the reality of Krishna's pastimes. And that means if Krishna is actually this, this and this, then I am not this, this and this. And that's very difficult. Whoa, wait a minute. I don't want to lose my footing in my own understanding of what I am. Krishna can be, but I can be too. So then we come back to what we put up here as a wrong understanding. I am the body, I am God, I will live forever, I can be happy here. There is no God, Supreme Lord is impersonal, for I have complete knowledge of what's going on. These are all wrong understandings. So the next one. How many times do we catch ourselves not thinking that the only object of life is the service of Krishna's desire? How much of the time? I have to say, in my own case, I very rarely think like that. Of course, when I catch myself thinking otherwise, I try to rectify the mistake in my thinking, but I perceive that a part of the mind goes right back there. And one time somebody told me something that helped me, and they explained that the mind is not a devotee. So you're associating constantly with a non-devotee. So then I started thinking, oh, that's not so bad. That's kind of a help to understand that, because it means you're associating with a non-devotee, not that you're a non-devotee. But the mind is a non-devotee. If you think like that, then what do you have to do if you're going to associate all the time with a non-devotee? What do you have to do?
Be careful.
What else? Beat them if maybe. What's a kinder thing to do if you're associating?
Preach to them.
Talk to them. Try to educate them. If you have children, you can beat them if you like. And then when they get very big, they'll beat you. Or you can talk to them and you can tell them and you can train them so that they understand something. And when they're untrainable, because sometimes children are, then you have to be very careful. So this is how it is with the mind. Partly we have to be very careful because the mind is really tricky, and partly we have to preach to the mind. And gradually, by the processes given to us, the mind can be rectified. And when the mind becomes rectified, the mind becomes what? What does Krishna tell Arjuna? Very dear friend. A very dear friend. Just as a family member, if you grow them up very, very nicely, and you give them so much attention and care, and they grow up very nicely, they can become your closest friend. And if they don't, if you don't make them your friend, what will they be? Your enemy. Because they're living right there with you, and all the time they're whispering in your ear, "Nah, don't listen to that. Nah, don't do that. Let's do this instead." So this is the interesting point, that we have to actually make the mind our friend. So the mind becoming our friend means it has to have the right understandings, not the wrong understandings. And so the beginning of this very challenging and perhaps even dangerous adventure of getting the mind to correct itself is to understand the nature of the Dhamma, to associate with the Dhamma, to go to the Dhamma, visit the Dhamma, hear about the Dhamma. If it's not the Dhammas in India, as we've been told, then it should be a Dhamma here. And if we say there's no Dhamma here that's potent enough for me, then your business is then to make a Dhamma. You make a Dhamma. You can do it. No, I can't do it. Yes, you can do it. You have to do it. Otherwise, you have got only your unfriendly mind as your company. So here it says, relationship with the Dhamma being established, the means of the service of the holy name. By the service of the holy name, it soon brings one to the only object of life, the service of Krishna's desire. This is the only object of life. Failing to realize the dignity of the Dhamma, we have no predilection for the Dhamma, for Dhamma's savor, and not so much faith in the Murti. Having remained engaged in worldly interests, but holy saints engaged in Dhamma savor have enlightened us by saying that it will bring us the highest welfare. So we put some things. What a Dhamma savor. And interestingly enough, there were things that can be done here. Chanting, serving the deity, attending festivals, taking the dust, instructions, following the instructions of Guru, cleaning, and serving the residents of the Dhamma. These things can be modeled to be actually favorable or available to us here. Not in the same way, perhaps. But if we really need something, we should take it wherever we can find it. He who seeks connection with the Dhamma finds his attachment to Gram. Now here's a fourth rhyming Bengali word. Gram means domestic, material, village life, home life. His attachment to Gram will soon become liquidated. In other words, if you develop an attachment to thinking that the Dhamma is my home, I'm a servant of Krishna, I chant his holy name, I want to live where he is worshipped, I want to serve him, then the attachment to a worldly family, materialistic family life, the attachment, it becomes reduced. Gradually it becomes liquidated. Then Sri Nam Seva, the means of attaining true blessedness, soon brings us our real end, namely Krishna Kam Seva. Mere pretense to serve the name, apart from the service of the Dhamma, and living aloof from relations thereof, does not lead to the goal of the science of the holy desire of Krishna. That should be actually service, the service of the holy desire of Krishna. Therefore it is stated that relationship with the worldly abode and hankerings after worldly, ordinary worldly life soon cease for one who realizes his relationship with the Dhamma. Does anyone have any points, questions, points or thoughts about this? How do we apply this? Yes.
Yes.
preaching the glories.
Another one that is very nice actually is remembering those places. So some of us here, I know, have not been to these primary places yet. How many people have not been to Mayapur? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, so you're very fortunate because you have something very exciting in store for you. And you'll have your first opportunity, no doubt, very soon to go and visit these places. You should expect that the first time you go there, they may not unfold before your eyes. They may, but they may not. You may feel a little, like I did, a little culturally shocked to begin with in one way or another. But then after that, you start to think, actually, now I can conceptualize what these places are like. And as we do that, they start to open up for us. And we start to realize what these words are speaking. And if we feel otherwise, if we feel confronted, if we feel uncomfortable, we're also very fortunate because that means that the operation is taking place. The correction is going on. So, oh, I feel a bit uncomfortable. So this is just like if you go to, sometimes to a chiropractor. Afterwards you feel, oh, my back is terrible because now it's aligned. Usually it's not. And so I feel very uncomfortable. But then if we continue to hold our position, then gradually it becomes quite natural to maintain an acceptance and an appreciation of this principle of the Dharma. The last one, Krishna Kam Seva. The service of Krishna's desire, Krishna Kam, saves one from the great danger of hankering for one's own sensuous gratification. Yeah, there's a stop and think. Do we all think that it's a great danger to hanker for our own gratification? No, we don't think like this at all. It's the purpose of life. Exactly. It's the purpose of life. And Krishna should help us with it. Hey Krishna, please help us. Dear Krishna, we are your devotees, please help us. So this is considered a great danger by a sadhu. He sees it differently than us. He says, when one becomes free of temporal lust or earthly passion, one may be firmly established in the service of the transcendental Kamadev, Krishna, and the Kama Gayatri. If we are fortunately able to secure attachment towards Krishna Kamseva, we can change the direction of the different inferior desires that have arisen within us for sensual enjoyment. We can change the direction. If we secure an attachment towards Krishna Kamseva, serving Krishna's desire. And I find myself one of the most important things in trying to get a taste for serving Krishna's desire. You must know him. If you don't know him, how can you do it? And so this will come up when we study the deity. And I have brought, you may have seen this book, one book called, I've forgotten what it's called right now, but it's about Ladini, who was one devotee who left this world in the early 80s, I think, 89, early 90s, and who was servant of the deities in New Vrindavan, sometimes of Jagannath. And when you read in that book the spontaneity of her mood of loving service, it's amazing. It's just actually amazing. It's funny because I actually met her a couple of times, so she was like a human being who walked amongst us. Wasn't like some reverential person up a bit above us, but she had such a vitality about in her. She was very advanced, obviously, from previous lives, but her feeling for the deities was so strong that, you know, she could forego anything, tolerate anything. You know, she was serving Lord Jagannath for, I think, at least 3 years, possibly much longer than that. And during that time, she was doing 6 aartis a day, all the cooking, getting up at 2:30 in the morning every day spontaneously, never missing a day, and going through the whole day, doing all the seva. The duties were about this large, and she did everything for them, and she wasn't even the slightest bit tired or frustrated by it. And quite the opposite, she was writing so many internal notes to the deities, praying to the deities, please don't change this, don't change anything, I can accept all these austerities, just don't leave, because she was deriving so much satisfaction. So I knew her when I first joined. I met her, she came to the Los Angeles temple, and she just seemed like another person. She'd come to learn some deity rules. And then years later, when I was living at Gita Nagari, some devotees said to me, you know this amazing devotee, she serves Lord Jagannath, da-da-da-da-da. And I said, what's her name? And they said, Nardini. And I said, oh, I knew her. She came to learn deity worship. And so then I was curious, let me see her, you know, if she didn't seem like anyone special. So I traveled at that time, she was living in Pittsburgh, I think. And I traveled there with a few devotees just to visit her. And I was like staring at her all the time, and she was thinking, you know, she was very friendly to everyone, but was like watching her thinking, you know, is this really true? And I couldn't really quite find anything that could convince me therefore otherwise, but everybody's stories were very fantastic. But then later I went to visit her again when I was living sometime in Washington. And I went to Vrindavan for a couple of days for a different purpose. And there I had a chance, a little more maturely, to watch her and talk with her. And she was very humble. She wasn't like... She had a funny crew of people around her. She wasn't in the mainstream. She was in a temple kind of in the back, and she was very quiet, but everybody could see the standard of her devotion. So seeing something like that, and then reading, I only saw a little of her, and then I read this book. And when I read the book, I could see, oh, that means it's possible. But maybe not yet for any of us that we can come to this point. We're not trying to rush in a frantic way to something we can't achieve. But this is the result of Krishna consciousness. It is possible. It's possible for all of us to have such a vibrant relationship with Krishna that he's much more real to us than anything else, because he is real. He is real. And now, whatever is standing in the way of that, those things that are blocking us from this, these things can gradually be removed by this processes of devotional service. And we can take up any one of them that we want, or we can take up all of them. But as we take them up, you'll see imperceptibly the misunderstandings, the superstitions, the prejudice, the worldly inclinations, the wrong ideas, they will slowly fade, and they become a little bit sort of transparent, like they're still there like a fog, but you can make out behind them that there's something very striking and something very good. So this is how one's devotional service develops. We'll finish. As the consequence of putting on this gross physical body, as we put on a gross physical body, base desires for gratification of the physical senses have cropped up. And in consequence of putting on this coil of the subtle material or mental body, indifference to the service of Godhead has grown up. Mental speculation keeps us ever running in the wrong direction. But this wrong direction is turned to right if the inclination and taste the service of Krishna's desire dawns. So this desire to please Krishna, we get this as a result of association with devotees, we get it as a result of chanting, we get it as a result of being given directions and trying to follow them. How else do we get it? Mercy of the spiritual master, how else? Mercy of the Guru Parampara, which is a very, very potent one that sometimes we forget. Attentive and offenseless chanting. And if this Krishna calm savor is available, if and when we engage in the service of Sri Dham. God is ever merciful. He has given us the only way, by means of our oral activity, to have a realization of the transcendental world. But if I do not take these things, I think that they are but the mutterings of ignorant people. Do not take the name of God in vain. In vain means for our selfish purposes. We are to chant the name constantly. We, the souls, should have no other occupation. Now, what I would like to do with you is I'd like to read one more called The Return Ticket. And I've given you two others, one on Mayapur, one on Vrindavan. I'd like you to read those yourself. And I would like to, after reading this section, we can have a few questions and answers, and then what I'd like to do is put this service to the Naam into practice. And I'd like that we could go out, this is a suggestion by some of the devotees, and have some kirtan walking around this area, so that we can create some auspiciousness and some Dham-like energy here, even in this remote place. I beg your pardon. Sometimes we leave something unsaid. We don't want to produce a challenge. Okay, this is called The Return Ticket. This is from Gorkhashodas Babaji Maharaj. Kailash Bandyopadhyaya, M-A-B-L, important man, once went to Calcutta to Kulia to have the audience of Srila Gorkhashodas Das Babaji Maharaj. When he was introduced, the latter told him, Gorkhashodas Das Babaji Maharaj said, "Very good. Now you should stay here for Hari Bhajan." Mr. Bandyopadhyaya replied, "Oh, but I have a return ticket for Calcutta." Babaji Maharaj was astonished at this, and he said, "You have booked a return ticket? So why have you come to me? There was no need of your coming to me if you have booked a return ticket. According to my understanding, only those who are genuinely interested in Hari Bhajan come to the Dham. There is no return to material life for one who visits the holy Dhams of the Lord with a steadfast vow to become eternally situated in His loving service." So when we read this, you can see it says, for one who does this, there is not this. That's important. We can only assume that Srila Gorkhashodas Babaji Maharaj expected Sriman Kailashji to return to his wanton materialism when he availed himself of his return ticket, rather than to return as a man altered by his association with the residents of the Dham. The particular benefit afforded one by a pilgrimage to the abode of God, manifest on earth, is getting the association of sadhus. Unless one surrenders himself in a mood of eagerness at the lotus feet of a genuine sadhu, one cannot derive the full benefit of visiting a holy tirtha. Mr. Kailash's excuse for not engaging wholeheartedly in devotional service was so trivial as to simply invite a stern castigation. So this was a little story of Gorkhashodas Babaji Maharaj's treatment of this particular gentleman. The point being, not that you cannot have a return ticket, and that he was admonishing that you cannot go back to your place of residence, but that one should wish not to go to return to his wanton materialism when he availed himself of a return ticket, rather than return to him as a man altered by his association with the residents of the Dham. So this is what we should actually wish for, even here, even in this short space of these 1.5 and a little bit of days, we should wish to be somehow or other altered. Because if we wish that, we shall be. Without a doubt, there will be some altering will take place. All right. The other two, which we won't read, are about Mayapur and Navadvip and Shubhendarbhan Dam. You might want to put them in. Next. The glories of Navadvip, of course, are described in the first one. That the benefit of Navadvip is that all offences are nullified and the residents are crowned with Sudha Bhakti. Navadvip is very special because if you go there, you get relieved of so many things from the heart just by going there. It's said that if you just sleep there, you get the reward of having paid your dandavat obeisances for the time that you're there. And Vrindavan also it describes here. One should go there because the pastimes of Radha and Krishna have taken place there. All right.